Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development will be in order. Today's date is Thursday, January 31st. As you can see, members, we don't yet have a quorum, but we thought if we started just right on time that people would perhaps come on in. But we always have that to weigh against not wanting people to miss what you're sharing with us, because we're really excited to hear today about both the SLED system, which is really important to us, as well as the state grant program, which the governor has proposed a significant investment. So that's an exciting thing. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, you asked that we present on two things today, the statewide longitudinal data system and the grant program. We're going to start with statewide longitudinal data system.
Director Pogemiller.
Madam Chair.
Say your name for the record, please.
Larry Pogemiller, Director of the Office of Higher Ed.
Thank you.
And I'm here basically to every so often pipe in.
Okay.
But the professional staff who preceded me at the agency is going to basically make the presentation today. And I want to introduce Meredith Fergus, who some of the members know, but she's the staff analyst and researcher on financial aid, but
very
also
good.
has been the key person on this SLEDS project across agencies and so forth.
Mary, and so I'll give you a chance to introduce yourself, but so you've been on it since the beginning, the SLEDS project?
Yes, Madam Chair. I've actually been on the SLEDS project since 2008,
oh,
I believe,
great.
Though I did have a little bit of work on it prior to that from another agency.
Very good.
Madam Chair and member, for the records, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm a policy analyst with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And as Director Pogemiller stated, I coordinate the higher education portion of the SLEDS data system, and I am the researcher responsible for state grant. So I hope he didn't kind of mean that as a warning that you're going to get 3 hours of me today or two and a half, but that's kind of just fair warning.
We're happy to have you here. Thanks.
Great. So we first wanted to start off with explaining a little bit about why we wanted to build the state longitudinal data system. And when I say we, I do mean the combined agencies of the Minnesota Department of Education, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So a statewide student longitudinal data analysis tool has been a goal for policymakers for many years. As I said, this is kind of the culmination of five or more years of extremely hard work by agency staff, as well as the combination of some funding resources. And so we're quite pleased with what we have to show you today. In addition, there are several national organizations that have supported state efforts to create data systems, including the Data Quality Campaign and the National Governors Association. In addition, though, we want to be fair. The federal government required Minnesota to build a statewide data system in response to receiving state fiscal stabilization funds in 2009 as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. In addition, the Minnesota Department of Education received a federal grant to build a state longitudinal data system. The SLED system was a recipient of $4 million of that grant. That grant expires on June 30th of this year, though we have asked for a no-cost extension.
And Ms. First, does that include the money we got for the early learning part of the longitudinal data system?
Madam Chair, no. The early childhood longitudinal data system was an additional grant received by the Minnesota Department of Education.
Thank you.
So the overall vision of SLEDS is to assist in identifying the most viable pathways for individuals in achieving success, and that would be success in both education and work. We purposely don't define success, as it can be defined in a number of ways, and we actually want individuals to define their own success, as well as legislators and policymakers. SLEDS does enable research to identify predictors of long-term success, to help design targeted improvement strategies for programs, improve data-driven decision-making, and to meet our federal funding requirements. So what have we been done? As I said, this is a project that has expanded more than 5 years. Officially, upon receipt of our grant, SLEDS as a project was adopted by the Minnesota P20 Education Partnership in April of 2010. Under that guise, we did develop three work groups, one for governance and policy, one for data and technical, and one for research. And those groups began meeting in November 2010. And those groups still meet. As part of that process, we did navigate and negotiate data sharing agreements between OHE and every public and private college in the state, as well as between the three state agencies in the Minnesota Department of Education, OHE, and DEED. In addition, we also met with federal technical experts throughout that period to help us with IT construction and data system usage, to help develop our research and analysis protocols and agenda, and also help with communications and sustainability planning. So here's kind of the big long list of data. So this is the data that is currently included in SLEDS or is planned to be included in SLEDS. So what you see is the three state agencies represented, the Minnesota Department of Education, the Office of Higher Education, and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. From the Minnesota Department of Education, we are including K-12 enrollment and assessment data. The goal is to include ACT data, including Explore Plan and the ACT entrance exam, advanced placement, adult basic education, kindergarten readiness, early childhood enrollment, and career and technical education. The data sets you see in bold have been included in a development system that IT kind of brought up this last fall. And the italicized data sets are those that are planned for a winter-spring release from an IT production perspective. From the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, we include post-secondary enrollment.
Yes? Thank you. So how about the ones that are neither in italics or in bold?
Oh, Madam Chair, those would be the data sets that are planned for a future iteration. So likely we've encountered some technical aspects that has delayed the inclusion of that data. That's like the most likely response.
Thank you.
In addition to post-secondary enrollment from all of Minnesota's public and private colleges, we do include post-secondary completion data from those colleges, as well as some basic information about organizational characteristics of the colleges in Minnesota. From the Department of Employment and Economic Development, we are including the unemployment insurance wage detail records. Those are the records that employers submit to DEED as part of participation in the unemployment insurance program. They do include data on hours worked for individual worker as well as wages received. In addition, we do pick up some employer detail from DEED, as well as some workforce training participant data, and we have talked about unemployment benefit recipient data. In addition, we also acquire several outside data sets. The one that's highlighted here is the GED test results, so those would be individuals who pass the GED who are Minnesota residents. In addition, we pick up out-of-state higher education enrollment and completions through a contract with the National Student Clearinghouse.
Yeah, Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you tracking the college and the schools data through the University of Minnesota and the other sites?
Madam Chair and Senator Klassen, we are able to pick up a limited amount of dual enrollment data. The one thing about dual enrollment data is that from a technical aspect, we can't really identify yet who is in college in the schools and who is in the other dual enrollment programs. So we're working on that aspect of the system.
Thank you.
Ms. Fergus.
Thank you. In terms of a research agenda, we noted that really after several discussions with stakeholder groups that really research questions came in the form of what we refer to as the four P's. And those P's would be pathways, progress, predictors, and performance. So essentially pathways questions from a variety of perspective involve what is the movement of individual students between K-12 or within K-12 and higher education and workforce? Who enrolls in college? When do they enroll in college? What levels of education lead to higher wages? How are those interaction effects coming out? In addition, we have progress. Those would be the benchmarks or transition points students meet or fail to meet. Predictors, those would be characteristics, patterns, and commonalities which help explain why some students meet benchmarks and some students don't. In performance, how well aligned are education and workforce for individual success? So in overall, most questions came down to those four areas. So now we'd like to show you a little bit of the data that we got out of the system. And this is, for me, this is the exciting part. It's 5 years of very hard work on part of our staff. So we'd like to start with the high school to college transitions data. This is data that was supplied by the National Student Clearinghouse for Minnesota Public High School graduates. So this first chart is simply a graphical display of the percent of public high school graduates who go on to college anywhere in the nation. So what you see in red here, what you see in red here, that is the percentage of public high school graduates who went on to college immediately after high school. So they enrolled in the fall term following high school graduation. The green means they did not enroll in the fall, but were enrolled in the spring following high school graduation. Purple, they did not enroll in the first year after high school, but did enroll in the second year after high school. And the blue means they enrolled not in the first or second year, but rather at some point after that, but before age 25. So in years 3 through 8. For the class of 2003, you can see that approximately just over 60%, actually 62.5% of graduates enrolled in college immediately following high school graduation. Overall, though, by age 25, 75% of Minnesota public high school graduates had enrolled in college. If we fast forward to the other bars, which haven't quite finished their eight-year data cycle, you can see for the class of 2011, the immediate college participation, so graduates who are enrolling in college in the fall, is now closer to 70%. In addition, we've picked up a similar chunk of students who enroll not in the fall but in the spring after graduation. So based on this data, we can tell you that the class of 2011 will outperform the class of 2003 by several percentage points overall by age 25.
That's great.
In addition, we can pick up information about which colleges those students attend. So for the class of 2011, this is a list of the top 10 destination colleges for those public high school graduates. The University of Minnesota does top the list with the largest percentage, about 5% of total public high school graduates. This does include both Minnesota colleges as well as out-of-state institutions. As you can see, North Dakota State ranks fifth for Minnesota public high school graduates. The list here is actually the same list you would see regardless of which class of high school graduates you were looking at. This list has been fairly consistent over the past 10 years. So we know where our public high school graduates are going. Now let's look at, in terms of public high school graduates, their college completion. So what...
Madam Chair, I just want to mention, you'll notice she's saying public high school graduates. We're currently working with the non-public high schools to try to get them to join in giving information.
Very good. And Ms. Fergus, can you give us any color on the remaining 75%?
The remaining 75%.
Well, 25% of your graduates are in this list.
Right. The remaining 75% of those who attended college would be at any of the colleges not listed. We know that approximately 50% of Minnesota high school graduates attend colleges in Minnesota, with an additional 20% attending out-of-state institutions. So those are largely going to be Minnesota colleges.
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Yeah. Senator Klassen?
Yes, thank you, Madam. In addition to the private school, are you doing any work or considering homeschooled students?
I think we would have to find out from K-12 how much they know about that.
Madam Chair and Senator Klassen, I believe that in terms of homeschooled students, there's a limitation on the data that's collected. But perhaps someone from the department has a better idea.
I think Ms. Hermanson's coming to the table.
I think our philosophy would be whatever data we can get, Madam Chair, Senator, whatever data we can get, we would like to get. So it would be totally an issue of what limitations there are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on homeschooling, we have a limited
access. Ms. Hermanson, could you say your name for the record?
Ms. Hermanson, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Education. On homeschool, we have a very limited amount of information because the law and statutes do not necessarily require that information be provided to us. There are requirements that they take some type of nationally normed test, but even that is at their choice. And also, there were changes made, I think, 2 years ago on what gets reported to a local district. A local district is primarily responsible for monitoring who's homeschooled and what's going on, but we do not collect that information at the department.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair. The next kind of analysis we did was to look at college completion rates for the class of 2003. So this gave us kind of an idea of what was happening after they enrolled in college. So we have in the current system, the data that I'm reporting, it's about 95% of public high school graduates. There's still about 5% of students who attended alternative learning centers whose data is not included in this analysis, so just keep that in mind. For the class of 2003, we noted there was just over 56,000 Minnesota public high school graduates. Of those graduates, 35,000 enrolled in college in the first year after graduation. The remaining 21,000 did not. Within the first 12 months after high school graduation, 454 students had completed a degree or certificate. Likely it is a shorter-term degree or certificate, but they did complete. If you jump ahead one more year, in the second year following high school graduation, we can see of those initial enrollers, approximately 4,500 dropped out of college. In addition, of those who did not start, 2,700 entered college for the first time in the second year after high school graduation. In addition, there were approximately 1,800 students who finished a degree in their second year following high school graduation. So using this type of analysis, when we look at the full 8 years following high school graduation, this is what we see. It's a rather complex flow chart. But what it tells us is that overall we can see that the majority of high school students do actually finish a degree in their fourth year after high school graduation. Though there are a significant number of students who finish before that point and after that point. In addition, there is a large number of students who drop out of college. And those would be the 12,000 that are just towards the end there. 12,000 drop out without completing a degree. In addition, about 14,000 of those original public high school graduates never enroll in college.
Ms. Fergus, we're trying to follow your numbers here. So, because we're looking in, if you look at the first ones that dropped out after that first year, that was 12.8% of the kids dropped out after their first year. But then if you look at the total that have not completed of the initial that first registered, what's the percentage over the four-year period?
That is exactly the next slide.
Thank you. Sorry.
No, I understand completely.
Okay.
So of that class, 62.5% did enroll immediately, and 26% finished a college degree or certificate within 4 years. So the difference in those numbers would be the number who enrolled but did not complete within that first 4 years. So about 38%. However, by age 25, 75% of public high school graduates had enrolled in college, and 48% had finished within that 8-year period. So 21% were no longer enrolled and did not graduate. In addition, 4% were still enrolled at age 25. 25% never enrolled. So our goal is to carry this analysis forward through for the classes of 2004 through 2011. In addition, we can actually go into each of these boxes using the SLEDS tool and analyze the demographic characteristics, the enrollment patterns, what institutions they're attending, some of their K-12 data on how prepared they are in terms of MCA proficiency. We'll be able to look at that as part of SLEDS and kind of do more nuanced analysis on what's exactly happening. Are there any questions on that section?
Sobering. Members. It is a little sobering. Just, I mean, that's that data, and we've gotten somewhat better. But when you think of our goal of each and every Minnesotan, we've got some distance to go. Thank you. It's great information. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you guys have information, and you may be getting to this later. I haven't paged through every one of the pages in the packet. Information on individual post-secondary institutions, graduation rates and things like that. And what my reason I'm asking the question is our high school graduates are demanding more and more information as it relates to their post-secondary options, and providing that information in a more holistic way to allow them to make informed decisions I think is important. So do we have that capability right now?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, we do have that capability. In fact, institutional graduation rates are one of the requirements that institutions must post on their on the U.S. Department of Ed College Navigator website, as well as their institutional websites. I think the larger question is, how do we make sure students see that information? And I think, if I remember correctly, and I'll ask Ms. Grimes from our office to correct me, is that it's part of the shopping sheet, the cost comparison sheet that the U.S. Department of Ed is implementing. The SLED system, however, those initial graduation rates, though, are limited in who they actually track. It is essentially first-time, full-time freshmen at an individual college. With the SLED system, you will be able to actually analyze all students, regardless of whether or not they were full-time, and analyze their progression through multiple institutions. So it actually provides a much richer data set for you, for us to convey to students. And that is our goal, to convey it to students and families.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then more specifically, and again, I might be preempting something here, but as it relates to teacher prep, colleges of education in particular, and information regarding that for, and I'm coming at this from the more teacher quality angle. Do we have specific data as it relates to teacher prep institutions in the state?
Madam Fergus. Chair and Senator Peterson, on that question, I'd actually like to defer to my Department of Ed colleagues. because that is a system that is being still developed within the Department of Education. So,
Senator Kent, in the meantime, as Ms. Hermanson's coming over.
She can sit this way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask a quick question?
Senator Kent, you can ask whatever you want.
before we switch out, on the chart with the mini boxes, on the no longer enrolled line, are those comparable year to year? I mean, they reflect the same set of data each year? So that increase is, we're really seeing that level of year increase year to year?
Madam Chair and Senator Kent, yes, those are actually cumulative numbers.
Okay.
So those would be approximately, if you look at the end, 12,000 students at some point in that 8-year period started but did not complete and are not enrolled.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I'm going to try to understand your question here a little bit. You're trying to determine how, if we know how well our teachers are prepared as they come out of the College of Education. Was that kind of the gist of your question?
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hermanson, I'm looking for any relevant information that you have on teacher prep grads. So it could be performance in the K-12 system and then linking that back to the K-12 institution. It could be really anything, the ability to track teaching graduates into to kind of, I kind of have a big thought here, but TSDL is another thing that we're going to talk about in the committee here. And so linking TSDL back to teacher prep becomes a very relevant conversation as it relates to increasing the caliber of teaching candidates that we have. So do we have the information and the links available to make some of those determinations?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, we do not collect information about where a teacher graduated from college. I'm not sure if the Board of Teaching does. They're an independent entity. I suspect they may have some of that information because they have to align their granting of a license to their training and background. And we may have that in our licensing division. At this point, I don't know. However, I do know that the Bush Foundation is conducting a very targeted study with certain school districts. You may have heard of it, where they are trying to, I think the idea was that they would guarantee that certain colleges would guarantee that their graduates would perform well. Probably the most thorough and best study of doing that may be done when they complete that study, and that is still ongoing as far as I know. I know we're working with one district with our principal evaluation process where they are also part of that Bush study. But at this point, the department does not collect that type of information to that level.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, if I may add to that, the one aspect we do collect, however, is we do look at college graduates, and we are able to track some employment characteristics to find out kind of what industries they're working in and supply that back to the individual colleges and programs. So that is one aspect we have successfully done.
And Senator Peterson, that Bush initiative I thought was pretty expansive. So I think that's something that we ought to pretty in short order follow up on and find out where they are with regard to that and how much of that reporting is being collected. Because for some reason, I thought, Ms. Hermanson, that they were collecting that data on all the teaching colleges in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. I know that there are certain partners that they're working with. I'm not sure if it's the entire array of colleges that do license teachers. That I can't answer for sure.
But we will get that information and address that in this committee. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Director Fogelmiller.
The type of discussions going on right now, we're making notes on that. Because if we can find a way to link that kind of data, why not, if it's available? And so that I think that's what you're starting to see here is as people start to look at what we are linking, they're saying, how about this? How about that?
Very good. Anybody else? Okay.
Including your committee.
Madam Chair and members, one of the reports that we are in the development phase of is what is commonly referred to as a high school feedback report. And so this is more of like a graduate or student profile in terms where we're aligning some pre-high school graduation characteristics with some post-high school graduation data. So we are specifically looking for alignment, for example, between proficiency on the MCA test and enrollment in developmental education in college, or students enrollment in college based on a student's demographic characteristic. So we are hoping we are in the process of developing reports that can hopefully align those. And this is kind of one example of those reports. What you see on screen, and I apologize because it's extremely small, but what you see is some pre-high school graduation data that we can summarize at the school, district, and state level for comparative purposes. And then we have some post-high school graduation data that we also align at the school, district, and state level for comparative purposes. In addition, the report will kind of cross those two so that you can see, for example, on the slide that's on the screen, the cross of a student's race and ethnicity by their enrollments in college. So you can see the differential college participation rates by race in Minnesota. In addition, we can also do that with MCA scores, such as we can cross the math proficiency by their enrollment in developmental education in college. So that's a report that we're working with the Secondary School Principals Association, the Minnesota School Board Association, and a number of stakeholder groups to kind of help facilitate that report's development. It will have both a program improvement perspective for schools and districts, as well as a consumer information perspective in making that information available to parents and students. The next segment of data analysis that we've been focusing on is college to workforce transitions. And ideally, we'd like this to be education to workforce transitions, but one of our data limitations is that we don't have a way to link K-12 records and workforce records directly. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Our main question in this section is to help determine what the return on investment is for students, as well as kind of the employment pattern of students. So this involves data that was taken on 2009-2010 college graduates in Minnesota. In that year, there were just over 72,000 students who finished a degree or certificate. This is anything from a cosmetology certificate to a PhD. We're taking all levels of education. We matched that up with the data from DEED, the Unemployment Insurance Wage Records. And just for clarification, those records are only on Minnesota employers covered by unemployment insurance, and therefore it does not include federal employers, military personnel, those workers who are self-employed, and those workers who are employed in other states. Of those 72,000 graduates, just over 75% of them were working in Minnesota 1 year after graduation. And for us, we determined that if they graduated in June 2010, we looked at what they were doing in April, May, or June of 2011. For analysis purposes, we did exclude Walden and Capella universities because even though we collect data from them, they are large national online universities and very few of their students actually reside in Minnesota. So this is kind of what we found out. As you can see, the highest employment rates for Minnesota employment are seen among the state colleges and the private career schools. Just under about 80% of students in those two areas who graduate from those two types of institutions are employed in Minnesota after graduation. The rates for state universities, private colleges, universities, and the University of Minnesota are slightly lower than that. And then you have the private graduate and professional schools would include William Mitchell as well as Luther Seminary, those very specific. On this chart, and I should say this is actually analysis that Craig Schoniker from the Minnesota State College and University System prepared for us as part of the SLEDS project. What you should note is that this chart is heavily influenced by two factors. The first is location of institution. For those colleges that are located in the Fargo-Moorhead area, they have significantly lower employment in Minnesota rates, which is not surprising given the geographic proximity of North Dakota. In addition, it's also influenced by the type of degree that is granted. So on this chart, you can see that for students who receive an associate degree or lower, their employment rates in Minnesota are about 80%. As you move into the bachelor's degree, they drop closer to 73%. That is likely because a number of students in that sector are going on to graduate school, and that graduate school may be outside of Minnesota. In addition, at the master's and doctorate level, you have more of a professional type degree, and that may allow them to move into more of a national job market.
Excuse me, Ms. Fergus, do we have some way to, if someone completes a bachelor's and then goes on, that we tie their record back so to be able to then capture if, you know, 2 years later they're in Minnesota, that they that's linked?
Madam Chair, absolutely. That's exactly what SLEDS is intended to do.
Great.
Regardless of when they're employed or even enrolled in Minnesota, we will be able to pick them up should they come back at any time.
Great.
So that will allow us for a very robust analysis.
And Madam Chair, Director, as the states start to link their databases, we should be able to track people nationally, too, what happened to them.
Wow.
The other analysis that Dr. Schoniker was able to do for us is an analysis of mobility of graduates. So we actually took each of these classes of graduates by degree level and tracked where they were employed. Were they employed in Greater Minnesota or the Twin Cities? So as you can see, for those at the bachelor's degree or higher, a larger percentage are employed in the Twin Cities metropolitan region. Those would be the 7-county metro area. For those at the certificate or associate's level, a high percentage are employed in Greater Minnesota. In addition, we looked at whether they were employed in Minnesota and where they were educated in Minnesota. So this next chart, let me walk you through it. The dark blue are those students who received a degree from a college located outside the Twin Cities metropolitan area and were employed outside the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The dark orange were those who received a degree from a college in the greater Twin Cities area and were employed in the greater Twin Cities area. The light blue and the light orange are actually those students who moved. They were the students who either got their degree in Twin Cities and moved to Greater Minnesota, or were in Greater Minnesota and moved to the Twin Cities after college. This is kind of just a kind of touching on the type of analysis we hope to do in terms of employment patterns of graduates and also their mobility after graduation and throughout their lifespan, ideally. You can also see that at the doctorate level, there's a high percentage that graduate in the Twin Cities area and stay in the Twin Cities area. In addition, we were able to look at the employment rate by major in Minnesota, so rather this very long list. And these are just what we refer to as the classification of instructional programs. It's a 2-digit code that's assigned to each educational program, and this allows us to track graduates within a specific program, such as teaching, as to what their employment rate is. These rates don't necessarily mean that they are working in their field, however. This does simply mean they are working. They are employed somewhere in Minnesota. In addition, we were able to look at the level of employment, whether it was full-time or part-time among graduates. So what you see before you are the number of graduates in each degree category, and they are split. The blue bar are those workers, those graduates who are employed at fewer than 35 hours per week during the quarter. The green represent those who are employed at 35 hours or more during the week, 1 year after graduation. It is approximately half for about bachelor's degree. Half of students were in part-time employment and half were in full-time employment. That part-time employment could have been full-time employment, but only for half the quarter, though. So there is some caveats to be seen. In addition, we were able to track what their wage rates were for each level of each type of graduate. You can see at the certificate and associates level, the wage rates range from about $15 to $17 per hour. At the bachelor's degree level, they increase slightly. And then at the graduate, master's, and doctorate level, they are much significantly higher. These are wage rates for the full-time employees. So again, just touching on the type of analysis we hope to do more of for you. In addition, we are working with individual colleges to provide a type of report that would essentially lay out these indicators for each program at each college in Minnesota. So that kind of leads more to the consumer information perspective and program improvement perspective on what level of how many of your graduates are employed and in what industries and at what wage rates and at what level of employment. So we have been working with several of the colleges to develop this type of feedback reporting. In addition, staff from the Department of Employment and Economic Development have actually done some great work for us on analyzing some wage data that involves pre-education and then post-education. So this is analysis that's done by Steve Hine from DEED, and essentially looks at what individuals were doing 2 years before they graduated from their program and 1 year after graduation. This is specific to those individuals who earned a degree in health professions. So as you can see, there were approximately 1,100 students who were working in the healthcare industry before they went to college. And after that, there was about 1,000 who stayed in the healthcare industry and 129 who left healthcare. In addition, you can see how their median wage changed. And please keep in mind that this was during the recession. So the 2007 through 2011 time period. The median wage for those workers in healthcare was about $11.42 an hour. For those who completed a certificate, their wage rose to $15.18 an hour. Even for those who were not employed in a health profession, their median wage rose to $12.28 an hour. In addition, about 2,200 students were not in the healthcare profession but chose to pursue a degree in healthcare. Of those, about 1,100 were working in healthcare after graduation, earning $12.61 an hour. Of about 1,000 of them were not working in healthcare, earning $11.74 an hour, as compared to their pre-enrollment wage rate of $9.88. So again, just touching on the type of analysis we hope to do. And we've included also the similar chart for construction trades. As you know, the construction industry was hit hard during the recession. And also some individual majors and kind of what kind of industry of employment they're working in. So you can see for those graduating in computer and information sciences, they actually worked in a variety of fields and at a variety of different annual wages.
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you. Are these two-year or four-year graduates? Do we know?
Madam Chair and Senator Klassen, for the health professions or construction?
Yes, either one.
Ooh. I'm going to look at Deb from Deed to see if she remembers. Based on our recollection is that for the healthcare, it is actually all certificate and degree levels. Though the numbers do seem a little low, they must be certificates.
And what?
I'm betting they're certificates. And the same for the construction trades. Those are specifically short-term degrees and certificates.
You could probably drill that down to the degree level.
Yes, we can, Senator.
And Ms. Ferguson, Senator Sharon has a question.
For the health care, you said all certificate and?
Degrees. Though so I
including baccalaureate degrees?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I know we have many more degrees in healthcare than this, so I'm thinking these are specifically the certificates.
Yeah, I think so. Based on the wager, the cost of the education is not returning value on cost.
Madam Chair, I would question those numbers as well.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out this is meant Director. To be illustrative because this is kind of the first output of this, and these types of questions are going to help the researchers think through how they do want to present it and how they want to slice and dice.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that we can see this kind of data and the correlation to the things that we're concerned about. It's great.
Well, Madam Chair and Senators, I just wanted to end with kind of talking a little bit about what our future needs are for the SLEDS data analysis tool. The first thing we're excited about is that the Department of Education has implemented the K-12 Common Course Catalog, and that allows for common numbering of courses. It is a multi-year phase-in, and so it will be a little while before we're able to get data out of that common course system. But it does allow us better analysis of the kind of courses students take prior to high school graduation. And our goal is to kind of help use those to help identify how they do in college and develop some of those predictors and program improvement strategies then. In addition, there's a couple of data linkages that have been problematic for us, the big one being the linkage between K-12 and employment data. Specifically, the Department of Education does not collect a Social Security number for students, as you may know. And in addition, the Department of Employment and Economic Development does not collect a date of birth. Those two limitations mean we do not have enough common identifiers on individuals, because their names may change over time, to allow us to directly link records from K-12 to the Department of Employment and Economic Development system.
Madam Chair, this is an area where now that our shop is going to become the face of this, asking for the appropriations, we'll be working with those other departments to try to bring recommendations to legislature on how to fix some of these problems.
And Director Pogemiller, Ms. Fergus, does, and perhaps Ms. Hermanson, when a MARS number is assigned to a young person, is there at that time no record of a corresponding? I mean, in order to provide a MARS number, one would think it's listed off a Social Security number.
Madam Chair, and I may have to have some help from our technical people, but I do think at one point in time the department did ask for the ability to gather Social Security numbers of students for free and reduced price lunch and correlation, and we were denied that. So I suspect that we do not have that authority, I don't think we collect Social Security numbers, quite frankly.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Claussen.
That is correct. As an educator, we cannot collect those Social Security numbers.
Madam Chair.
Director.
Other states are doing it, and so that's one of the things we're looking at. There's some nuances here in terms of what you can and can't do. I believe K-12 did use Social Security number until 5 or 8 years ago.
Mr.
Madam
Benson.
Chair, I wasn't at the department 5 or 8 years ago, 10 years, but I do think there's been some concern about us having those, and I haven't been part of the discussion in the interim there, but I do know that there was some reluctance on the part of the legislature to have us have that information or how it might be used.
I understand, and for members who haven't served on education, who may not know that every pupil in our system is assigned a MARS number. So I just would have thought that at some point it predated. But, okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Just to clarify, it was an option. Parents could provide that at one time. So we really had a mix. We had MARS numbers. We had Social Security numbers. And I think we finally gave up.
And Madam Chair,
Ms. Hermanson.
The MARS numbers are used for us to assure that student records are intact as students maybe transfer from school district to school district, or, you know, assure that each child is being educated. But Senator Claussen is very, very correct. And I do remember some discussions here at the legislature where we did ask for that ability, and the legislature at that time decided no. So.
Well, we look forward to hearing the recommendations, because I think that you will hear around this table, of course, a commitment to protect privacy, but also to be able to get meaningful data.
Correct. Madam Chair and members, the other kind of data gaps that we're facing and kind of perusing through is the fact that we do not collect data from private K-12 individuals. So that is it's an area of interest where there are several of the private K-12 organizations who are interested in participating in SLEDS, specifically to get access to that longitudinal post-secondary and employment data. And so we have been kind of initiating conversations with them to begin figuring out how to do that. It's more of a complex process.
Director. Madam Chair, members, I'm very optimistic. The private colleges already participate, and I think the K-12 system will come along.
Great. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of specific questions and then a few higher-level questions. As it relates to pre-K, when I see that listed, but there's no timeline as far as when that's going to be available, the link from pre-K to K-12. You guys have a...
Your next slide, isn't it? Madam Chair and Senator, what you're referring to is actually what the Department of Education is funding through its early childhood SLEDs, and that is a more recent data system that's under development. Ideally, we do plan to align the data tools, both the early childhood portion, which would include that early child family education, preschool programming, and kindergarten readiness data, with the full SLED system, and in addition to actually the Workforce Data Quality Initiative, which is more that adult employment and training program data that DEED has as well. So in the long term, yep, we totally plan to align these systems and make sure they can interact with one another.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, is there any different question? Is there any action plan to make this data more accessible to the public or legislators in general, all stakeholders for that matter?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator, that's actually the stickiest part of the whole process, I think, is trying to set not only the making sure we meet federal and state data privacy requirements of very different data sets and very different governance strategies, but also trying to figure out what the protocol should be for allowing access to the system. Our goal is to ensure that we have some level of access for program improvement, not only for access of state agency researchers, but external researchers who are in that realm. In terms of that process, we've been working diligently over the last 18 months to kind of ferret those out, and I believe we're close. We should have some level of access policy available this spring, and then I can answer your questions more specifically. In addition, there will be an aspect of SLEDS that will be public reporting, likely on a website where parents and students can access those summary-level data, summary-level reports about individual schools, districts, colleges, whatever they end up being. And so that will be a public information system that's available for use. In addition, we know that the Department of Education has been has worked a lot to make sure that data flows back to individual K-12 schools and districts. And so we totally see SLEDS as being part of that feedback process.
Senator Peterson, any thoughts you want to share while they're, you know, developing that policy about what kind of access you think parents and community members would like?
Yeah, I'm willing to have that conversation. I don't need to get into it because there's a lot that I'd like to have access to, quite honestly. But I'd offer myself up. I'm very interested in, to the extent you need legislation or anything like that, feel free to contact me personally. And then just a couple of higher-level questions. Can you just take me through the governance structure of this system? You've got the three initiatives up there. It seems to be, even in your testimony, very divided. Is there a future plan to have a singular governing body of the data systems?
Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I don't think we've actually talked about a single governance body for the three systems, but it's probably something we should talk about. Right now, SLEDS is governed kind of by an interagency group that includes the commissioners of DEED and MD as well as Director Pogemiller. And in conjunction with the P20 partnership, they kind of set our policy agenda for the SLEDS system. So, and we are in close alignment with the work that's being done on the early childhood and workforce side. We meet regularly. So we're trying to develop policies that are mirrored in each system to kind of facilitate that work. But, yeah, I would agree. It sounds like something we should probably talk more about.
Well, and to that point, I saw earlier that Commissioner Parnell was in the room. I don't know if she still is. But what is the role of OET in orchestrating and implementing this effort?
Madam Chair, when you look at the request, I stated earlier that the decision's been made in the administration to make our office kind of the face of this now. And so the request we've made for, I think it's about $1.7 million, about 1.2 of that is a direct pass-through 2 minute, basically to keep the thing running technically. The additional money is for further development of data sets. And I think the long-term objective is to create a system that is usable by policymakers, that is pretty seamless, but protects the requirements legally of protecting data in each of these areas, because there are different federal laws regarding all of these data sets. And so I think you'll see an evolution where across the country people start to understand how you can make this data available to people but still protect privacy. Because what you really want to talk about is kind of cohorts of people. You don't want to talk about individual people. You want to talk about people like this, what happened to them. And so it's evolving, but I think the intent here is to streamline this in a way where you fit the purposes necessary for policymakers to use information in an appropriate way. And whatever you decide the limits are on making it public directly to the public, that'll be a policy discussion. You'll have to decide how much of this do you want to just put out there publicly for people to look at.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So in my opinion and what I've seen across the country is that the most successful model is a PETA workforce data governance structure. And that allows you to prioritize kind of answering what critical policy questions you want to ask for. And it creates a singular kind of spokesperson and advocate for the system and the way it's used, which kind of leads me to my last question, which I think is a finance and funding question. Is there any plans? I know you have an appropriation that you've asked for. I firmly believe, I mean, this isn't a fad. This isn't something that's going to be a one-time deal. So one-time money from the feds is not going to do the job. Is there a plan to ask for a stable funding stream to provide continuing work in this area?
Yeah, Madam Director. Chair, Senator, that's what I was trying to articulate. Just to keep the black box running will be about $1.2 million for the biennium. But we're also building in addition development money that is not money to pay for staff and agencies, but is money to say, how would we get that data set? And that's about $300,000 a year, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So the absolutely what you're describing is what the intent here. It's meant to be a tool, not a project. It's meant to be a tool that is always available to policymakers to go where you want to go.
And Director Pogemiller, is MNIT the lead on developing the actual infrastructure?
I think the infrastructure has been created. They'll be taking it over in terms of the pass-through money through our agency. But the actual development work will be done in these individual agencies who understand data and will say, here's what we need. I don't think the technical aspects are going to be that difficult. The ultimately, it'll be how can you link these data sets? And so it will come to you soon on this policy issue of, can we use Social Security numbers? Is that a good idea? Should we ask to get data from homeschools? It'll start to be of that realm where we'll want to be interacting with policymakers to say, where do you want to go here? What makes sense to you and what laws need to be changed? And so I think you're going to become very active participants here as policymakers.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Senators, I would add to Director Pogemiller's comments in that MNIT has been a very essential partner to us and all the state agencies, not only by having their staff within our agency, but also helping us with the more technical guidance aspects of how to align systems across state agencies that previously didn't do much talking to one another. And so without that leadership and kind of expertise in our working groups, we probably would not have gotten as far as we have today.
Madam Chair.
Director.
Example of that is the chief information under the consolidation that just the legislature put in place last year or the year before. The CIO or the chief information officer for our office and for K-12 is the same person. So the whole idea here is we're trying to streamline this, get it set up in a way where it functions across agencies.
And Senator Peterson, that's why I raised the MNIT thing, because I think with regard to governance across the various sectors, that consolidated effort should diminish the silo tendencies that would normally exist.
And Madam Chair, since I brought up, that person is Matthew Parrett, who is stand up, Matthew. He's the CIO for two agencies.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Pogemiller, a lot of data here. Has there been any analysis from your office that's been done that you're looking at right now and saying this is something we need to address first, so to speak, or something there that you're looking at?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it's starting to emerge. There is a I don't know when this is going to be announced or put out, but all the agencies have been working on a dashboard for the state on indicators, and data from this system is being used on a dashboard item that describes what you did in college and what did you get paid for afterwards to find out whether people can pay back their debt. So very early stages, and I think we'll be looking for guidance from policymakers as to what are the kind of things you really want us to start to go for. So it's very initial right now and very rough, but the potential is really significant, it seems.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Rose Sherman, Service Department. One of the things that, as we've played with this a little bit, one of the things we also have to rely on is the information we get from our constituents. In other words, we have, 300 and some school districts. And we have to constantly verify that the Dave Olson that is here is the same, because we got lots of Dave Olsons. And so a lot of this will be to make sure our data and our information is accurate. And as we have to then interact with our constituent groups, which are school districts and others, in order to make sure our data is accurate and correct.
Okay, Madam Chair, should we move to the next topic?
I think so. Members, we're ready to move to the state grant system. Thanks for your attention. And the state grant program is something that is very, very critical to our mission as a committee because it is the vehicle that we invest in that goes direct to students to help offset the expense of college. And so as I started the committee, saying the governor has committed a significant increase in that program, and so we're here today to really understand what the state grant program provides, what's missing, and what does this proposal change.
And Madam Chair, I'll start on the first two slides and then turn it over to the professional staff. And we really appreciate, or let me just say this, the professional staff who's been around for a while, they are so thrilled that a committee wants to genuinely try to understand the nuances of this. It cannot help but be useful for everybody. So I'll just start with two quick slides. First is to remind you that the governor's proposal is holistic in the sense that he's trying to deal with early childhood, K-12, and post-secondary afterwards. So he's got the all-day K, the scholarships, formula, special ed, teacher evaluation, et cetera. And then in the higher ed side, the access issues with the state grant, the tuition issue at the university, and then the governor's supporting Chancellor Rosenstone's suggestions on internships, apprenticeships, and skills gap stuff, as well as research at the U of M. So just to remind you that there's the idea here is to think about this all at once and try to help you deal with all at once, particularly in higher ed then. The next slide, Meredith. His approach is a balanced approach between direct institutional support for the contingent at the University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, I want to keep saying that based on the work you're doing in this committee. But $80 million there, $80 million at MinSCU, direct institutional support for their activities, and then $80 million for direct aid to students. And so his general thought was, here's a balanced way to deal with all of these issues. Doesn't solve all issues, but it starts to approach them in a balanced way.
Madam Chair and members, I would be the professional staff that will lead you through this kind of technical discussion. The state grant formula is a complicated formula, but trust me, after a while you will understand it. So sometimes I dream about it, and that's probably a bad thing. But the Minnesota State Grant Program is the state's largest need-based grant program. To apply for a Minnesota State Grant, a student must complete the free application for federal student aid or the FAFSA. This is the same form they complete to apply for a federal Pell Grant, as well as federal student loans. The Minnesota State Grant is limited to Minnesota residents attending Minnesota institutions who are U.S. citizens or eligible non-citizens. Last year, in fiscal year 12, we did award $145 million to 83,000 undergraduate students. Approximately one in three resident undergraduates receives a Minnesota State Grant. The Minnesota State Grant Program was established by the legislature and follows this legislative direction in that the identification of men and women who are economically disadvantaged and the encouragement of their educational development at institutions of their choosing is in the best interest of the state and students. As of last year, I did want to give you kind of an idea of the distribution of Minnesota State Grants. As you can see, the vast majority of recipients of Minnesota State Grants are low-income students. Approximately 71% of recipients have incomes under $40,000, and those would be family-adjusted gross incomes. In addition, the Minnesota State Grant coordinates with the federal Pell Grant, whereas the federal Pell Grant is concentrated among the lowest income students. The Minnesota State Grant supplements that award as well as expands eligibility through the middle income groups. So this is what it looks like for an individual student by income level. As you can see, the average Minnesota State Grant and federal Pell Grant award is just over $5,000 at the lowest income levels. And then approximately at $40,000, we start to decline in award size level. This is actual data on students, so it never quite performs as well as I'd like it to. The maximum Pell Grant is about $5,500, and there's a supplement to the Minnesota State Grant on top of it. But given that students have different family sizes, what you see here is the average among those incomes. So the Minnesota State
Grant. Ms. Fergus, could you go back?
Yes.
I just want members to take a little time. Because are we going to be talking about this particular slide later? Because I think this is an important one. So, so let's put this in perspective with what tuition costs at our average tuition of our various institutions. So it looks like the average combined state and federal Pell Grant is about what?
Just over $5,000, Madam Chair.
And then, and that's a year. And so can you share with us the average tuition, including, you know, books? I guess we're leaving off room and board at this point, or it's up to you. But give us some relative scope.
Madam Chair, we do have a few slides later in the presentation that talk about that. For example, the average tuition at a public two-year college is just over $5,600 per year. The average tuition and fees at a state university is approximately $7,600 per year. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities is at $13,526. And at a private four-year institution, it is $33,373.
There's a slide coming with that data.
Okay, thank you. But so let's. I'm sorry. Senator Fischbach, go ahead.
Oh, because I just wanted to ask, Madam Chair, and Director Pogumiller, Ms. Ferguson, is there a slide that's going to explain where that that high level is going to, where the distribution? So if they're getting 5,000, are they going to a private school? Are they going to a public school? Or is there a slide later without having to jump ahead?
We do have that data available, yes, Senator.
Okay, because I'm curious, because that would be interesting alongside what Chair Bonner was asking.
Yep.
Madam Chair, so the Minnesota State Grant is based on the design for shared responsibility. And essentially what that means is that as a state, we expect the price of attendance to go to college to be divided among three payers: the students, the families, and the taxpayers. Specifically, the taxpayer portion is divided among the federal Pell Grant and then the Minnesota State Grant as the last dollar in.
And we want to, Madam Chair, differentiate that from how the federal Pell Grant is set up. We have a shared responsibility model here where there's an expectation that the student will participate because they're getting some private good out of this. The federal system is not set up that way.
Correct.
Describe how the...
The federal system works off a maximum award type system in which they set a maximum award currently at $5,550, and then they subtract out a contribution based on your current income, assets, and family size. There is no student expectation in as part of that unless the student actually earns some current income. There's no expectation of future benefits received. Okay. So to start with the formula, this is where the technical part starts, sorry. But the recognized price of attendance is the combination of tuition and fees. What we're showing here is the four-year program maximum of $10,488. And then it adds in a living and miscellaneous expense allowance of $7,000. And we have some more detail as to those components in a second. In addition...
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
The earlier numbers that you gave us are not the recognized price of attendance. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, you are correct. We actually cap the recognized price of attendance. So this would be the number that would be applied to students at the University of Minnesota or at a private college whose tuition exceeds this amount. For those students at institutions under that number, we use the tuition fees charged by their institution.
So, Ms. Fergus, you're saying that this is the recognized, so not the actual.
Madam Chair, you are correct, yes.
Okay.
In addition, of that total cost that you previously saw, we expect students to pay the first 46% of their educational costs. We do that because as they receive their degree, they are the primary beneficiaries of that degree in terms of future income. So we feel that they have a responsibility to pay part of those costs right off the board. As you can see, that expectation does not differentiate by income. We expect all students will receive a benefit to their education.
And the we here is the state of Minnesota, not the Office of Higher Ed. This is what the state has developed.
The next, we actually take a snapshot of the family's income, assets, household size, and number in college. We do that by using the results of the federal need analysis and moderating those to calculate what the assigned family's responsibility is. So as a family's income and assets increase, they are expected to contribute more to their students' educational costs.
And mention the different types of structures, family structures.
This first chart, Madam Chair and Director Pogemiller, this chart is actually representing a dependent student at the University of Minnesota. And so this curve right here is kind of the assessment rate we apply to dependent students. If you are an independent student, your assessment rate is much closer to the actual vertical axis. So it actually moves forward. So at a lower income, you are expected to contribute more towards your educational costs if you are an independent student. And for some of those groups, that expectation is rather quite high. That expectation is both in the federal Pell Grant calculation as well as in the Minnesota State Grant calculation.
And Ms. Ferguson, by independent student, meaning?
Madam Chair, we do mean a student who is 25 years or older, a student who is a veteran, or a student who has dependents other than a spouse. Oh, no, with a spouse. Sorry.
So, Madam Chair, we're assuming if they have dependents that they're more capable of paying?
Madam Chair, actually, if they have children, we actually assess them as their own family unit. We essentially assume that they're not relying upon their parents to pay for their or their child's care, but that they are on their own, kind of outside the parental household. It's those students who are under age 24 and who do not have children or who are not married or who are not military veterans that we the actual federal policy, and hence the state policy since we use those results, actually assumes that they have some parental resources available. However, as you can see here, for dependent students, that expectation of resources does not start until approximately $30,000 in income. And $30,000 in available income. We do have an income protection allowance in the federal policy that does allow for some extra income for basic living and employment needs. Madam Chair and members, the next assessment we make is what is the student's federal Pell Grant? And so we just simply take that into account. As you can see, the federal Pell Grant goes to the lowest income students and then slowly decreases in amount size as the income increases as well. The final component to the Minnesota State Grant design is that we actually do calculate an award for students. In this example, the awards range from $0 at the higher income levels where you see no green to approximately $4,300 for the lower and middle income students. So the program parameters that were displayed in that chart are actually established in session law. We do have a recognized price of attendance in session law of which includes tuition and fee maximums of $10,488 for four-year programs and $5,808 for two-year programs. In addition, the session law states that the current living and miscellaneous expense allowance is $7,000. In addition, we also have set in law the assigned student responsibility at 46%. The results of the federal need analysis, though moderated in terms of the assigned family responsibility, and that the remainder is to be covered by Pell and State Grant.
And Madam Chair, the though moderated in the last two means we change, in Minnesota, we change the slope based on adding money because we think the federal need analysis is too steep for families.
So even though it appears complex on screen, for those of you who like math, this is the actual formula for a Minnesota State Grant. Tuition and fees capped plus living and miscellaneous expenses equals the award budget. We then prorate that budget by the number of credits a student enrolls in. We assume if they take fewer credits that they have lower educational costs. Then we subtract out 46% of that budget as the assigned student responsibility. Then we subtract out the assigned family responsibility and the amount of a student's Pell Grant to calculate a state grant award. The minimum state grant is $100 annually or $50 per semester, $33 per quarter term. Our minimum award is much lower than the federal Pell Grant, whose minimum award is at $555. So we are able to provide students with smaller grants if they qualify.
Ms. Fergus, with all due respect, it seems just inconsistent that in our formula we don't recognize the actual tuition at our state colleges.
We're getting there.
And the university. Okay. All right.
Well, that'll be a discussion.
No, we're getting there right now.
No, but okay. I mean,
Senator Sharon.
I think you're putting your pulse on something that will need a lot of discussion, whether or not what the universities charge is the number that we should be using in terms of determining what the state's interest and contribution should be, which is what the issue was when we started to talk about this earlier.
Yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to give you the reference to statute that includes the definitions for recognized tuition fees and living and miscellaneous expenses.
We think that statute should be simplified.
So our first parameter we want to go a little more in detail in is the recognized price of attendance in terms of tuition fees and living and miscellaneous expenses. So tuition,
Ms. Fergus, I'm sorry, that went very fast. And so could you go back to it?
The statute, Madam Chair?
Yeah, thank you.
Essentially, the statute states that if you do not set a number in session law for either for the tuition and fees, that it will be set to the highest public 2-year or 4-year institution in Minnesota. In addition, it also states that an amount for living and miscellaneous expenses is set in session law. We have no alternative in statute otherwise. We do benchmark both the tuition and fee maximums and the living and miscellaneous expenses. Right now, the 4-year program is at $10,488 as compared to University of Minnesota Twin Cities tuition of $13,526. The 2-year program maximum is $5,808, and that compares to Dakota County Technical College at $5,623. The University of Minnesota is currently over the cap, and within the next 1 to 2 years, the MinSCU 2-year institutions will begin to exceed that cap as well. In addition, the living and miscellaneous expense allowance is typically compared to inflation, as well as the federal poverty threshold and the consumer expenditure survey. The consumer expenditure survey is data on household expenditures over the course of a year through diaries that the Bureau of Labor Statistics collects that allows us to track expenses in various categories on a national level. So this is kind of what those benchmarks look like graphically. The living and miscellaneous expense currently set in law is about $7,000, and that compares to federal poverty guidelines for a person of 1 for 9 months of $8,300. In addition, it compares to national average household expenditures for a 9-month period of $12,869.
And Madam Chair, just for context, the governor's rec moves from this to this, and for this... to this for the 4 years, and from which direction here? Which to which on the 2 years? Here to here. Here to here.
For the two-year programs, we hope to align it with the highest public 2-year institution rate, which is currently Dakota County. As Director Pogemiller stated, the tuition and fee maximums, we show them here as compared to the average tuition fees at the state universities or public 2-year colleges, as well as the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and the private nonprofit universities.
So, I'm sorry, Ms. Ferris. So, the governor's recommendation moves the recognized maximum for 4 years to...
The University of Minnesota's real number.
Oh, good.
And
okay.
to the 2-year real number, which is Dakota Tech.
Senator Sharon.
No, I'm just saying that I heard you say good. And I'm saying that's the discussion, I think.
The discussion. And where I'm coming from in the good is at least recognizing what's actually happening.
Madam Chair and members, even though we align the 2-year institution to Dakota County will be over the cap starting next year if the 3% increase is enacted. So that's why we aligned it to that number. This is
Senator Sharon. anything? I mean, do you want to say anything about some of the concerns? Because I think it's important to get both sides out on the table.
Well, I think that's what you're presenting is what the governor's proposing.
Right.
But it's not yet in any action or legislation
no.
for us to be.
So no.
I'm just laying it out there that there is alternatives, views on whether or not we should be using the highest tuition rate as the as the new number that we calculate this formula against. That, I think, is yet for us to have a conversation about what it implies, what it drives, what it creates, is an outcome that may not be what it is that we want. So I want to have that conversation.
Good.
I just want to indicate that.
Good. Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, we did provide a historical graphic that shows you what the tuition fee maximums at 4 years has been over the last 20-year period. So you can see in 1994, both the University of Minnesota and Minsky were well under the 4-year tuition maximum. It is only in the most recent 5 years that the university has now exceeded that. The university is the blue bars, and our tuition fee maximum is the red line. The next parameter we'd like to go into detail on is the 46% assigned student responsibility. It, again, is set in statute under 136A.121, subdivision 5. This is a historical chart of what the assigned student responsibility for the Minnesota State Grant Program has been over the last 20 years. As you can see, when the program was first implemented through the early 90s, it was set at 50%. It then decreased to 47%, then 46%.
I was just going to say, first established was 83, right, 1983? So the chart goes back to 83.
Correct. It is currently at 46% members, and this blip in 2010 was actually when program demand exceeded available appropriations, and so we had to reduce awards. One way of reducing awards is to increase that number for all students. And this is simply what it looks like on our chart, our model chart. In terms of benchmarking the assigned student responsibilities, I actually show you in the blue bars what that ASR amount looks if students attend, for example, an average Minsky institution or an institution charging average Minsky two-year tuition and fees at a four-year institution at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and at a private college. Those amounts range from just over $5,700 to just over $8,000. Keep in mind, for the University of Minnesota and the private nonprofits, not all the tuition fees is recognized, so students do have some costs beyond this amount. These are benchmarked to earnings of approximately $8,500 if a student works 20 hours a week at an average wage of $8.47, which is what the state work study wage average is. For 50 weeks per year. In addition, it is compared to what students can borrow through the federal Stafford loans. Freshmen can borrow $5,500 in their first year, then it increases to $6,500 in their second year, and then $7,500 for their junior and senior years. The next parameter we'd like to talk a little more about is the assigned family responsibility. So this is families as the second payer. Minnesota statute does designate that we do use the results of the federal need analysis, and that is the calculation that uses information from the FAFSA and calculates a student's EFC, or expected family contribution, and determines Pell Grant eligibility. The statute does also go into and adjusts each of those outcomes based on type of student. For dependent students, we reduce that amount to 96% of the federal results. For independent students with dependents, we reduce it to 86%. And for those without, we reduce it to 68%.
Madam Chair, in English.
Thank you, Director.
That's where this slope of this line is. This lowers the slope. So we go over, we think the slope, Minnesota thinks that the federal needs analysis is too steep for those groups, and so we actually put money in to lower the slope so we can get into.
And I think it should be said that you know, when it says that's the family responsibility, I think because of the recession, that less and less of the family responsibility is actually being shouldered by families. And in fact, students are carrying it, because I talk to many parents who tell me that while they'd love to help their kids, that in fact they can't make ends meet. And so I think we should all understand that when we look at the slide that says family responsibility, it may really not be the case.
And
Senator Sharon.
But the family responsibility is based on that. As their income changes, so does family responsibility. So the recession, if somebody loses a job in the family that was a parent that was for the shared responsibility, that as that income changes in the family, the slope changes for them in terms of shared responsibility.
Where they're on the line changes,
yes,
not
right.
The slope.
And it's
an annual snapshot.
Yeah, right.
You take an annual snapshot, just like taxes, and say what's your ability to pay.
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, in extreme economic circumstances, those amounts can be adjusted mid-year as well. But financial aid directors have that authority. The chart before you just simply shows what those contributions are according to federal policy. You can see for a family whose income is approximately $50,000, depending on what type of family are, we expect them to contribute, or the federal policy expects them to contribute, between 3 and 30% of their income at that level. For families earning $100,000, we expect them to contribute between 16 and 37% of their income. Minnesota moderates that slightly. We reduce those contributions at $50,000 down to between 3 and 20% of their income, and at $100,000 between 13 and 25% of their income. So very, very steep assessments. The next segment we typically take into account is the federal Pell Grant award for which the student is eligible. Current Pell Grant awards range from $555 to $5,555. The $5,555 would be for a full-time student taking 12 credits or more and having a zero expected family contribution. We do take the Pell Grant into account because Pell Grant funds allow the state flexibility in targeting state grant dollars to specific populations to increase our overall eligibility and to help offset rising costs. So as Pell adjusts, we can adjust as well to meet state needs.
And Meredith, you may not have these numbers, but to show you how much federal money it takes to change that number, in the last 4 or 5 years with a very significant federal increase, it went from 3,000 to 5,500. Or what's that? How much federal money went in to do that?
Ms. Fergus?
We'll get you that number. It's a lot of money at the federal level, billions of dollars, to move from whatever.
Madam Chair and members, a $100 increase in the maximum federal Pell Grant does allow us to adjust Minnesota state grants overall by about $8 million. That's how much it frees up within our program.
Wow.
And we'll get you this number. I was stunned. At the federal level, you hear that there was a lot put in at the federal level during the last 4 years. That is true. But it only moved that, I think, from 3,500 to
4,050. Under President Bush, the maximum Pell Grant was approximately $4,050.
Okay, so.
And under President Obama, it's $5,550.
But it cost a lot of money to do that at the federal level.
Yeah. Senator Sharon.
I hate to be the only one asking questions here. Come on, you guys. Remind me again, you said this before, I'm sorry if it's the brain is slowly absorbing things, but I think maybe Senator Pogermiller was talking about this, or Director Pogermiller, that the Pell Grant is based on income, and that's pretty much all it's based on. So they have a maximum amount that they can give no matter how poor the family is, or no matter how expensive the school is that they choose to go to.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, you are correct for Minnesota institutions. The Pell Grant does take tuition and fees and costs into account. However, their maximum cost is so low that pretty much every college in the nation is over that amount. So it does take it, but it's really not a realistic assessment of cost.
Senator Sharon.
Do you mind if I...
Oh, please, Senator Sharon, please
so
do.
So that cost that you're talking about, not the not real cost, how is that number established?
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm not exactly sure. I believe, and our technical people can correct me if I'm wrong, that it essentially says that it would reduce the amount of a federal Pell Grant if the student's costs were less than $5,000 annually. I'm getting a nod that I was correct. So that would typically be an extremely short course of study and an extremely low-cost institution. Even our shortest two-year programs in Minnesota typically exceed that amount. So we are subject to the maximum, the $5,550. You are also correct, though, in that the maximum award simply subtracts an expected family contribution, which is based on the student's income, assets, family size, and number in college. So it just takes that $550 and subtracts the EFC. That is how it's calculated.
Senator Sharon.
I did not understand that at all.
I didn't either, Ms. Fergus.
I did not understand that.
I didn't understand that either.
And maybe my question was off or something, but I thought you said that there was a tuition cap set. Like we set a tuition, or we set a cap of 10,000 something for that we're going to contribute for, and everything sort of calculated off of that. I thought you said there was one at the federal level, too.
Madam Chair and Senator, let me try again. Yes, there is a cap. It is not just a tuition cap, though. It's a combined cost. So it is taking the living expenses and tuition fees and adding them together to create their cap. And their cap is actually $5,000, I believe. So it is a very low cap compared to ours. And that includes both tuition fees and living expenses. So for reality, pretty much every college in the nation is over that amount.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. That's right. I understand that. But the point also is that the federal government as well is going to have a conversation if they would change that number to somehow relate to what the pricing. It's like letting my kids say well, we'll get into it. I just think when you talk about whether or not you want to buy your children some jeans,
right?
And they come back and say, you know, I want choice. I'd like choice in my purchase of my jeans. And this happened to me and my family, so that's why jeans are on my mind. I want Jabot jeans. I don't know if you remember those, but they were expensive jeans for high school kids. And we said, and that's the real cost. That's the real cost of jeans. And I should have choice. That's the reality of the cost. That's what the market has set. That's what the university set. That's what the Minsky system has set. They set their price. So you should adjust what you're giving me to purchase those jeans. And I'm saying, no. Not that I don't care about you having some choice. Not that I don't think that choice is a good thing. But we have $30 to give you for jeans, and if you want to work on something more than that, then maybe we'll have to figure something else out. That's the point I'm trying to make when we're talking about this, and what I'll have to be persuaded to understand why I would think differently about that, because I think the unintended consequence of some of what the governor's proposing here is that we don't that we aren't addressing the issue of letting the market drive what it is that we're going to spend for education. And I want to have a more thorough conversation about why I should think differently than that about it. So,
very good.
I will keep quiet for the rest of the time.
Senator Sharon, don't ever keep quiet. That's what committee's for. This better be a committee where people can voice dissension.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Ms. Director Pogemiller.
And what I'm going to discuss with you is if your child chooses that very expensive jean, you've said to them, I only have $30. That child then gets to make the choice. Are they going to put in their own money? That's what's going on here. If you choose a higher option cost, your cost individually as a student, your ASR, your student responsibility goes up. Now, it's absolutely true. The family can pick up the student responsibility if they want, but the family can also say, no, we've capped out what we're doing for you. So that's kind of the thing that you have to keep in mind, too. This all adjusts based on whatever choice you make.
And Senator, I promise to say nothing more, but I'm going to break my promises, as usual.
Yeah.
I agree with that component of this. I absolutely agree with that. Where I'm struggling is that move to the university's tuition rate. That's the number. Everything else, about 50% of the share, you know, I think I can get there, and all of the other components. But where we set that number, I think, is something we should have to conversation about, because
Director
it's a
Pogamiller.
Limited amount of money, and where it gets distributed between the systems is impacted by where we set that number.
Madam Chair.
Director Pogamiller.
This is aside from the professional staff, but Senator Sharon, if the University of Minnesota was your local college, you would understand why someone would think that.
Why someone
if
would
your,
take...
If your local public college was not Mankato State, but the University of Minnesota, you would then have a... That's the perspective someone might think about that. Their local public college is the University of Minnesota. It's not Mankato State.
No, but there's other...
Senator Sharon.
There's other public institutions in the metro area other than the University of Minnesota. Metro State.
So I think what we will wrestle with is what is, you know, the role of each of these various institutions, and what role do they play in our community and in our state and in our future. And so everything's relative, you know. You know, we look at the tuition rate of University of Minnesota, but then you look at the tuition rate of Carleton College and the tuition rate of St. Olaf and the tuition rate of Illinois. So it is all relative, and these are questions to grapple with. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, the final kind of payer in this Minnesota State Grant formula is the state of Minnesota. So the Minnesota State Grant is awarded. However, if the combination of payments from students, families, Pell Grant, and State Grant do not cover the actual price of attendance that a student is paying, so the full tuition fees at the U, as well as a full amount of living expenses above and beyond the poverty line, or the $7,000 in law, then students are relying on additional student loans, parent loans, and hours of work to cover that cost. So they essentially do have to pay it, regardless of whether we recognize it or not. In technical terms, we refer to this as the implicit student responsibility, meaning that it's not explicitly identified in the program, but it is implied through our combination of policies. So we also want to talk a little bit about affordability. So we recognize that college affordability and student debt is a concern for both students and parents in Minnesota and nationally. We also, in referring back to those multicolored line charts, we do feel that the percent of income required of some students and families to pay may be unreasonable to expect. And the state grant program's effectiveness in addressing affordability is also limited by the fact that we don't recognize the actual cost that a student pays. So it's set artificially low and doesn't reflect those realities. We feel all of those factors contribute to affordability concerns for our program. So this is what we mean in terms of implicit student responsibility. Essentially, the light blue at the top of the chart there, those are the costs that students are paying, but the state grant program isn't recognizing. So in addition to the $8,044 and the $9,444 some families pay, they do actually get charged an additional just over $4,300 in terms of actual enrollment, tuition fees, and living expenses within Minnesota. This is what it would look like at Dakota County. Because we don't recognize the full living expenses, even though we recognize full tuition for a Dakota County student, we still expect them to pay an additional $1,300 beyond the amount recognized within the state grant program. And that accrues to all students regardless of income. So the implicit student responsibility, which we also refer to as the unrecognized price problem, falls disproportionately on low and moderate income students and families, because upper income students and families may have additional resources they can tap. If the recognized price within the state grant program more closely matched market prices, then more low and moderate income students would receive a state grant. And this would include independent working and part-time students because of the concentration at those lower income levels. One could then also realistically assess the burden on students. So is that ASR amount, can it be covered through a combination of work and loans that is not excessive to the student? In addition, we feel that a policymakers that more accurate data by recognizing the price is kind of key to how we assess those rates. So So until prices within the state grant program match market realities, we do feel that the distribution of payment assignments and grants will be inequitable across incomes. Once the price is set, then it is possible to determine what level of resources are needed to target to which students. So we're not assuming that you would automatically cover everything, but it allows us to set a stage for what portion of that price of attendance can the state cover through the grant program. In addition, I'd like to add in this chart on net price for first-time students. The U.S. Department of Education now requires institutions to report cost and grant data by income level. And so this is the data for Minnesota colleges. You can see for students in the $0 to $30,000 income, they do pay just under $10,000. And at $10,000 at the University of Minnesota, the state universities, and the public two-year institutions. And that's, again, for a $0 to $30,000 family. For students at the upper income, the public two-year students pay just over $15,000, state universities at approximately $17,500, and the University of Minnesota just over $20,000. And those would be out-of-pocket costs after all grant and scholarship aid is considered. So that would be the amount we're expecting students and families to cover with loans and works currently in Minnesota. This does include a standard living allowance of $12,000.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question that's not really related to what you're talking about. Well, it's kind of related, but do you, just curious, have percentages of students that self-finance their education, meaning they didn't receive public money or public loan assistance or anything like that?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson,
Ms. Ferris.
I imagine we could get that data from the National Postsecondary Student Aid Study. That study is a few years old, though. It's students from 07-08, so pre-recession, but we could look at that. In addition, I'm looking at Ms. Grimes to see, can you think of anything else?
70% take out loans.
Yeah. Approximately 70% of Minnesota students do take out federal student loans.
And so, Ms. Fergus, I know that I've seen statistics that show there are a certain percentage of students that have zero debt. It seems to me that's the group that would be most related to that question. Of that group, you might find that many of them didn't take any loans, that they just self-financed.
Correct, Madam Chair. That's very likely. We can do some more investigation into that.
What is the percent that has, I think you've got the, are we going to see that in a slide, the percent that has no debt at the university and at MNSCU?
That is data we do have, I believe.
I think that's your answer.
Madam Chair, members, we've been collecting that debt and we're about ready. We're checking it back with the institutions for the 2011. Ms. Grimes, it's a 2011. We're hoping to have that to you publicly here within days.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Yes. When you gather that data, we have students that receive academic scholarships, athletic scholarships. Are they included in that data or are they excluded as far as paying their own way, so to speak?
Madam Chair and Senator, in terms of, for example, calculating net price as is shown on the chart, those scholarships and grants are included. In terms of the debt data, I would defer to Ms. Grimes on that. I'm not sure.
Ms. Grimes?
Madam Chairman, I'm kind of trying to find it on the fly here.
Can you say your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Okay, this is what I was looking for.
Maybe it'd be most efficient if we just get you that in a manner that tries to respond directly to these questions.
Okay. Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and members. So now we'd like to talk explicitly about the governor's recommendation. This is you.
A context again, Madam Chair. You've seen the data we showed. Others have shown, too, but over this period of time, from 86 to now, the level of public investment appropriations per student has been dropping. But the contextual question is total revenue per student has actually gone up, and that's tuition. You would expect, if all that was made up was for the decrease in appropriations, you would expect to have a flat line there rather than a line above the direct horizontal. This is to reinforce the notion that the only money involved here is not state appropriations. Matter of fact, you remember when I presented, between 75 and 82% of the money comes out of families and students, not out of public dollars.
In terms of the Minnesota State Grant Program, the governor's recommendation includes three changes. The overall investment in the state grant program is an additional $80 million over the biennium. There are three recommendations under that proposal. The first is to set the tuition and fee maximums to the highest resident tuition at the Minnesota public institutions. So that would be the University of Minnesota Twin Cities for four-year programs and right now Dakota County Technical College for the two-year programs. In addition, the governor would increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance from $7,000 to $8,300, which is the poverty level for a single individual over a nine-month period.
And contextual, the university Director. Believes that number is about 12,500, not 8,300.
The third recommendation would be to increase the student share back to the 50% in which the program started. In terms of increasing the tuition fee maximums, we have benchmarked them under the governor's proposal to the highest resident tuition fees at a Minnesota public institution. In addition, we feel that the state grant model We note that the state grant model has been recognizing tuition and fee increases for MNSCU students, but has limited those increases for University of Minnesota students since 2008. If we actually limited both sets of students to the increases that the University of Minnesota has been subject to, MNSCU students would see a decline in overall state grant spending by about $19 million. So that's kind of the estimate of what has been funded for MNSCU that has not been funded for the University of Minnesota. In addition, the gap between the recognized price for University of Minnesota students and the tuition fee maximum is $3,038 per student.
Ms. Ferguson, yeah, excuse me one second. Ms. Ferguson, are you saying that as you've raised the cap, or as the actual price has gone up for the university, but yet below the cap or even at the cap, you've proportionately raised the eligibility? No, I what
the I didn't point is question. More that the actual tuition fee increases occurring at MNSCU have exceeded the increases for the tuition fee maximum within the state grant program. If we were to hold both of them equitable to the same percentage increase over time, then actually we would be spending about $19 million per less for MNSCU students. But the fact that we've allowed the tuition increases for MNSCU to flow through the program and not allowed them to flow through for University of Minnesota students, it has created a disproportionate impact.
And Senator Claussen.
Yes, thank you. We're looking at the highest resident tuition and fees, and you mentioned earlier it was Dakota County Technical College, and that's the base it's coming off of. And I know over the years, the two-year colleges, universities, technical colleges, have been dropping athletic programs where Dakota County Technical College has been adding those. And I'm just wondering what the impact is on raising that tuition at that institution to be the highest in the state, and should we be looking at that because it's an artificially inflated cost if indeed we're including athletic programs which are being added at that institution?
Madam Chair and Senator Claussen, you are correct in that we don't take that into account. So if there was some way to take that into account, we can certainly provide that as an option.
And members, I would just like to say we didn't really plan that we're going to discuss and debate the governor's recommendation today. We don't have a bill before us. So so those are good questions, and we can ask questions. But members, we will have a full and thorough discussion of the governor's proposal when it is before us in a bill format as well.
Just for clarification, are you saying then that those program costs are calculated into the highest tuition rate for Dakota County Technical College, or it's not?
Madam Chair and Senator Claussen, I'm actually not sure. I'd have to actually consult with my MNSCU colleagues to determine that. I am simply using their published tuition and fees.
Yeah, thank you.
In terms of what that disproportionate impact of the differential funding for University of Minnesota students and MNSCU students are, approximately in 2008, you can see that we actually started, not explicitly, but implicitly, increasing the student share for University of Minnesota students from the 46% that it was in 2007 to currently, we expect University of Minnesota students to pay 54% of their educational costs within the program. The second recommendation from the governor's proposal was to increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. We did set that to approximately the poverty guidelines for a single person on a nine-month period. In terms of increasing the student responsibility to 50%, what this allowed us to do was to ensure program equity and the payment responsibilities and move back to the 50-50 split that the state grant was founded under. In addition, we feel it places the program on a sustainable long-term path for funding students. It does allow us to redistribute limited resources in a manner that benefits all students as well. So it was a critical part of our proposal.
Senator Sharon.
I'm sorry. Would you go back a slide? Mm-hmm. And would you remind me, this is for the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. He's setting a higher rate for that now. Can you remind me, how is that calculated? How is that distributed? How does a student get that?
For the Madam Chair and Senator Chan, for the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, essentially the student would receive 54% of every dollar in LME as part of their state grant award.
54% of every dollar.
Every student.
And it doesn't make any difference where they're going, what the tuition is, so this is a way, at least we have in the past, that as we've had increases in the state grant programs in order to make it certainly equivalent through all systems, that we've used this as a way of getting more money to students, is this system here.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, you are correct in that this does provide the same benefit to all students regardless of income and regardless of cost, so tuition and fees, yes.
Ms. Fergus.
In terms of the governor's recommendation, we wanted to show you exactly what the impact would be. So in terms of what we see, under the current population, 95,300 students would receive slightly larger grants under the governor's proposal, and those would be across institutions. In addition, an additional 5,300 students would receive a state grant under this proposal that they would not receive under current law. Total state grant recipients would increase to approximately 101,000 students, which is the level we were at in fiscal year 2010. In addition, you can see that the highest number of recipients are at that lowest income level, though there is a substantial population of new recipients across income levels.
One of the governor's objectives was try to help in the lower middle income or middle income, depending on how one defines that.
And Director Pogamiller, to that point, is there 80,000 or more? Is there a cap on more?
A chart will show you kind of
Madam
where
that
caps
Chair, yeah. Director Pogamiller, there's not an explicit cap. Because we take into account income, assets, number of persons in the family, as well as number in college, right. If you have an extremely large family or a family with numerous children in college, they can have a relatively higher income.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, this chart actually shows that in terms of the governor's recommendation, we are trying to achieve a grant level that is comparable to what we have seen in this decade, but due to recessionary activity and limited appropriations, we have not been unable to do. In addition, you can see that the number of recipients here and the new recipients as well by year.
Senator Sharon.
Back on the governor's recommendations, back one slide. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to, you don't have to do this now, but I'm looking at the new recipients by institution, and I'm wondering, you know, if you could show us that in relationship to the number of students that are served by that institution in a four-year, you know, MNSCU is all the students in MNSCU. There'll be 39 new recipients, all the students in the four-year. Because I think that number doesn't necessarily tell the story unless we understand that.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I can actually show you in the context of the number of students who apply for the program from that system. Would that Would that be okay? I don't actually have detailed on students by income and sector for those who do not complete the FAFSA.
In English? She
yes.
can tell, based on who applies through a FAFSA, we can give you that information. But not every student applies for a FAFSA or fills out the form.
Senator Peterson.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So going back to the slide that was just, well, actually going forward to the next slide, am I reading that then the average increase for the average state grant recipient is $271?
Madam Chair.
181?
Senator Peterson, yes, if you're looking at the difference in these two numbers, the 1647 to the 1928. The 1647 does include that extra amount we spent this year on the living and miscellaneous expense allowance because we had a surplus appropriation at the start of the year. So this is higher than what you would actually see in 2014 under current law. So the in 2014, the base is actually just slightly lower than that. So it's about a $300 increase on average.
And Ms. Fergus, in that same time frame, what's the has the average changed on the Pell Grant? So they're the combined award.
Madam Chair, which time frame would you?
So
be
now we're
to?
Looking at that with the governor's recommendation 2014-2015, we're up to that 1915 amount. With the federal changes, what would be the combined?
The combined grant, if the Pell Grant stays stable at 55-50, the combined grant would increase by the amount that the state, or a proportional
so
amount that the state grant.
Grand.
If the inflationary adjustments to Pell Grants are funded, which we do not have a lot of hope that they'll be funded, but then they would have increased through the inflationary adjustments.
And I think I have this right. In context, you're talking about $300 over 95,000 students. There's a distribution there for type of student.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, we also wanted to show what the distribution by income of those new recipients are. So the green is our base population. They would see their grants increase slightly. And then the blue represent the new recipients by income. You can see that it is actually quite proportional by income. And it does allow us to extend our eligibility in this upper income range just slightly.
That's it.
Very good. Complicated stuff. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fergus, I think I'll be dreaming of the state grant program tonight. So,
We hope so.
Can you please explain the current state grant formula, how it affects full-time students versus part-time students, and then how the federal Pell Grant plays into that as well?
Madam Chair and Senator, I certainly can. Let me flip back to that formula slide just so that we're aware.
Quite a formula. That,
it isn't? So in terms of full-time and part-time students, the definition of full-time for Minnesota is 15 credits. So for students who take less than 15 credits, this enrollment ratio kind of comes into play. So it proportionally reduces their budget on which the state grant award calculation is based. So if they take 14 credits, we take 93% of their costs. Part of that is that they will pay less tuition and fees because they're taking 14 credits instead of 15. In addition, we do decrease the same proportion that living and miscellaneous expense allowance. In terms of the federal Pell Grant full-time definition is 12 credits. So it's already, that's the first difference. In addition, the federal Pell Grant does brackets of credits. So rather reducing based on each single credit the student takes, 14, 13, 12, they reduce it in terms of threes. So you have one award if you take 12 credits, which is equal to 100%. You have if you take 9 to 11 credits, you receive 75% of the federal Pell Grant. If you take 6 to 8, you receive 50% of the federal Pell Grant. If you take 1 through 5, you receive 25% of the federal Pell Grant. And so essentially the federal Pell Grant creates this longer stair-step approach, whereas Minnesota moderates that approach somewhat.
Senator Miller.
Madam Chair, just so right off the bat, a full-time student, according to the state grant program, is 15 credits, and the federal is 12.
Madam Chair and Senator, yes.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, context, if you're going to graduate for a baccalaureate, if you're going to graduate in 4 years, 120 credits, divide that by four, and that tells you that you need to take 15 credits a semester to graduate in 4 years.
Madam Chair and Senator, I would add that the 15 credit definition has been in law since 1993.
So. Madam Chair, what was it before that? Was it 12?
Madam Chair and Senator, I'd have to look back, but I believe it was 12 credits, yes.
We think so, yes.
And Ms. Fergus and or Director Pogamiller, what is the University of Minnesota and MinSCU consider full-time?
Madam Chair and members, the University of Minnesota has an explicit policy that students must take 13 credits or more. Given that classes are typically 3 credits, essentially most students take 15 at the University of Minnesota. At MinSCU, I do not know what their explicit policy is. I believe they follow federal policy, though, in the 12-credit definition.
Yeah,
and
sir.
Director Mr. Holling is shaking his head yes.
So Ms. Fergus, the 12 credits is considered a full-time student at MinSCU.
Madam Chair, yes. In fact, 12 credit is the federal definition, so that is actually the policy that sets the level at which you receive a full-time Pell Grant and the full federal loan amounts you're eligible for, is that 12 credit level.
Thank you. Senator Sharon?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on what you're looking at, Senator Miller, and, you know, historically the definition for some time has been at 15 credits for this calculation. Has anybody done any runs or anything that what would happen to some of these distribution numbers of grants under what the if we increase the tuition to 13, but we lower full-time student definition to 12, what would happen?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the program spending would increase dramatically because both of those are essentially expansions of eligibility and higher grant levels. But I can actually run those numbers for you and come up with a definitive cost estimate. Yes.
I'm not sure of where I would go with this or if I would, but I do know that in the presentations earlier, when you take a look at what is the portfolio is how I think about it, a portfolio of business at the University of Minnesota in terms of students, academic success, and what it takes to get in there and the complexity that the two-year or the MinSCU system takes on in terms of part-time students or first-time students into an educational system, that you don't want to set up a system that makes it, if that MinSCU system is carrying a special responsibility statewide in terms of how we support new students, newly entering members into the educational system, that we try to find a way to make certain that we're not getting this grant system set up in a way that they have less resources for that system. So maybe changing that, which is what I think you are going towards, Senator Miller, is it relates to this other picture that you've given us about what these systems look like in terms of who they serve and what the and not so much that they're choosing a particular system, but the character of the student that's in the different systems and the complexities of the problems with which they are dealing with should be reflected somehow in how we push out this grant. So I'm interested in what you're thinking about there, Senator Miller, and
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon. That's
Senator Miller.
Exactly what, and I don't know how to get there, but maybe we can work together and try to figure that out with Director Pogamiller and his staff to try to at least find out more about that and then maybe try to work toward a solution.
Madam Chair.
Director Pogamiller.
Absolutely. just a background, though, remember, not all the money involved here is public money. Tuition's involved. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that you need to consider how much money institutions gather through tuition. You know, the more students you have, you get more tuition. And then you got to make some judgment on this. It's a balance between access and real-world prices. Access and choice. You got those things all going on at once here, and you just got to think through that and balance. And that's why you're here, to think through that.
And there may be some discussion and trade-off with regard to cap and those kinds of credit equations, and that'll be a discussion.
Absolutely.
Well, great conversation today. We thank you for bringing it forward. And Director Pogemiller, I've heard from my staff, but maybe you could confirm that we might expect to see a budget in the next week or I don't mean a budget, a bill in the next week or so.
I think I've been told February 6th is what the leadership and the governor's office have kind of set upon. And
Director Pogemiller, will that just be a budget with regard to the finance, or will that include policy as well?
Both. In terms of governor's rec, it'll
right.
be both.
Good.
And to the extent that the governor's rec overlaps with the MNSCU or the university recommendation, that'll be there too.
Great. Okay. Very good. With that, there being no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.